Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. President Bush convenes his first cabinet meeting of his new administration this morning. He will hold his first news conference in about an hour's time. It is assumed that some of the names and faces of his administration will change over the next month. But it is less likely that any political principles will change. They are the principles that work for this president, and we now know that they are the principles that appeal to a majority of Americans.
Our nation has defended itself and served the freedom of all mankind. I'm proud to lead such an amazing country, and I'm proud to lead it forward. Because we have done the hard work, we are entering a season of hope. We'll continue our economic progress. We'll reform our outdated tax code. We'll strengthen the Social Security for the next generation. We'll make public schools all they can be. And we will uphold our deepest values of family and faith.
This hour, we're talking about who today's Republicans are and how they won this election. We'll analyze where the center of gravity is now in the party and discuss the agenda the GOP will be pushing now that it has won four more years in the White House and such a firm grip on Congress. We'd like to hear from you as well. Who are the voters who stood with the president this election? What do they believe in and what do they expect from their leaders now? Now that the GOP has such a hold on power in Washington, do you think that Democrats and Republicans will see this new term as a new opportunity to reach out to the whole nation? Or do you expect the partisanship to continue? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The Republican pollster Ed Goas is joining us from NPR's Washington studio to start off the program. He is president and chief executive officer of the Terrence Group. It's a top Republican survey and research group. He's been with us before. Ed, it's nice to have you back.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Someday, I suspect years from now, you're going to be invited to explain exactly what was it that ensured or marked this Republican victory. What do you think you'll say?
Well, I think what we saw throughout the election is that even though there was a divided America in terms of partisanship, with a slight edge to the Democrats, about 1 or 2 points, and a lot of loyalty, with 92% of Republicans supporting Bush, we had 88% of Democrats supporting John Kerry, that kind of overstated where the American public was, that in fact there was a recognition that the war on terrorism was important and that the president was approaching that war correctly. There was a understanding that while we took a very, not only at the beginning of Bush's administration going into a recession, but took a very hard hit to our economy during the 9/11 or from 9/11, a million jobs lost in the first 90 days, a $1 trillion hit to our economy, that there was a recognition that things were moving in the right direction. And if you look at the job approval for the president, most polls had him at over 50%. But also, I think another thing, the kind of a misunderstanding sometimes of where the center of gravity is with the American public. In our polling, we don't ask, are you a moderate? We ask, are you conservative? Are you liberal? Are you very conservative then or very liberal? And what we find is about 58% of the American public says that they are conservative. Only 33-34% of the American public are liberal. You have about 8% that volunteer that they are moderate, and we record that.
So are you saying that it was loyalty this time around?
No, those people
who identify themselves as conservative said, boy, we really have to get up and get out.
Not just that. The true center of American politics really is center-right. And so when you look at policies that are center-right in terms of the war on terrorism, in terms of foreign affairs, policies that are center-right in terms of economic policies, that truly is the center of American politics. It's something that I think President Clinton understood very well. Yeah. If you look at his policies in the last 4 years of his administration, they were also somewhat center-right, both on foreign affairs and economics.
Okay, so to drill then right into the center of what the Republican Party is today, do you look at November 2nd as this sort of coming together of the religious traditionists, the economic conservatives, the foreign policy hawks, or is it something bigger, something longer lasting than that?
I think it's something bigger. I think the real division in the Republican Party, and there's been a lot talked about this over the last 25, 30 years, has not been the Republicans that are focused on values versus the economic versus the foreign affairs Republicans. Mm-hmm. It really has been a difference between the no-government Republicans and the effective government Republicans. If you look at Ronald Reagan, for example, he really, from some of his original Democratic roots, really was more focused on effective government than no government. And you really have seen with George W. Bush, him kind of being the other bookend, if you will, to that policy. And I think today in the Republican Party, effective government, there is a role for government, but we need to be effective and efficient in how we deliver and work with the American public, deliver to and work with the American public, being really the focus much more than the best government is no government.
Let's bring Karen Labar into the conversation now. She is a conservative Christian Republican activist joining us now on the line from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Karen.
Good morning, Dick.
I want to ask you, first off, how much time did you personally put in to this election, to ensuring the re-election of President Bush?
I guess I've been working on it for a couple of years in a lot of different ways, informing my friends and people in my church about political issues and about values and how that plays out in the political scenario.
Did you ever doubt that this victory was going to happen?
I certainly did.
Go on with that.
Well, I think that it's a very difficult situation when the major media and the education establishment, academia, and the entertainment industry are all on the opposite side of my values, almost monolithically. And so I think the incredible money and power and everything else that went into it, plus a major party, the Democrat Party, mm-hmm. having a platform that embodies things that I disagree with, all of that was arrayed against President Bush, and I did not take it for granted that this would happen this way.
So put yourself in front of an audience of that opposition that you just described, and tell me what the one thing that you would say to them to say who you are. I mean, what's the one message that you want that liberal, East or West Coast, Democratic audience to know about Karen Labar and her family and the people that you know?
I would say that we're a very busy bunch of people who are raising our families, doing our jobs, contributing to our communities through volunteer service, and that we don't have the access to the loudspeakers that they do, but we're the kind of people that you turn to when you need help. We're the kind who come over to your house with a hot meal when your wife is in the hospital. We're the ones who take care of your kids when you've got an emergency in your family.
And you don't think that happens in a Democratic neighborhood as well?
Oh, I think it does, but I think that the focus of people like myself is on our families and on our responsibilities, and we don't have a lot of time for politics. I think the people who are way out there pushing the agenda of the left have more time than I do to contribute to it. They're in positions of power where they're being paid for that.
So what's the number one issue that you want to see this administration go ahead with now, Karen?
I think this whole thing of the culture of life is the way that the president talks about it, and that would include the pro-life issue, unborn victims of violence, stopping human cloning, not experimenting on small human beings, using adult stem cells rather than embryonic stem cells, which actually have greater potential for good, at least in animal experiments and in what's been done on human adult stem cells. That whole sense of life is precious, and we need to protect it, and that spills over into national security issues. We need to protect our country from outside attack, and we need to establish just government in Iraq, as we're doing in Afghanistan. It's got national security implications. It's got implications for all of life. People
so,
are
so
precious.
All of this then kind of follows with what Ed was saying earlier about you're on that side of people who want effective government, a government that is pushing the policies that matter most to you.
Yes, and those are not necessarily economic self-interest. These are cultural right and wrong, good and evil, do what's right things not that may cost me plenty.
Right.
It's not about the economy. It's about right and wrong.
Go ahead, Ed.
There is much I could add here. One of the things, if you look at white conservative Christians, very often you find the national news media talking about the religious right.
Yeah.
19% in the 2000 election, 19% of the electorate are registered voters were white conservative Christians. We've seen that grow to about 21%. It's a huge part of the electorate. It is not a minority part of the electorate. And they are, we saw in the 2000 election, their intensity was a bit lower. The DUI story coming out the Friday before the election had a dampening effect on their turnout in that election. In fact, they only mm-hmm. comprised 14% of the votes turning out. To the extent you can look at exit polling did show about 21%, 22% being white conservative Christians. And so they were much more involved. We saw going into this election their intensity 7 points higher than union voters. Very, very high intensity, with about 83% of those voters voting for George W. Bush. And I think they have gotten involved. They are concerned about the war on terrorism. They are concerned about the economy. They are concerned about their families. But you also saw kind of a polarization that occurred, kind of two parts. One was coming out of 9/11. They really did rally around the president more than any other group in the country, almost to the extent more than Republicans. But also you saw the gay marriage issue really kind of drive their intensity. They, as Christians, have been taught to be tolerant, but they viewed the gay marriage issue as crossing this line where they were being asked to endorse a lifestyle contrary to their values with an institution that they value very strongly, and that being the institution of marriage. And so you really did see that help prop up or increase the intensity of these people where they, in fact, were asking the question. I've, for years under tolerance, not voiced strongly my values and the importance of those values in today's society. I think they're now beginning to question whether or not they should be, not in an intolerant way, but just in an expressive way, express what those values are.
When we come back after the break, more with Ed Goas and Karen Labar on the new mandate, the affirmation of President Bush that the election on Tuesday has given him. Some people are talking about a revolution. Is it time to be talking about how the mandate changes, and certainly time to be talking about what the expectations are of all those people who stood behind and beside President Bush? We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection this hour, a conversation about the people who were standing with the president in this week's election. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Ed Goas is with us. He heads the Terrence Group. It's a top Republican survey group. And Karen Labar is a conservative Christian Republican activist joining us on the phone from Atlanta, Georgia. Karen, I want to come back, if I can, to where Ed ended, and that is amendment that was also being voted on in Georgia, where I understand what close to 80% of Georgians voted for this amendment to ban same-sex marriage, right?
It was to define marriage as being only between one man and one woman, yes.
Wasn't there already a Defensive Marriage Act in Georgia?
Yes, there was.
So what was this one doing that was, why were you able to mobilize people behind this one as well?
Well, I think if you put this on the ballot at any time, any place in most of this country, as Oregon proved, you're going to get a vast majority of the citizens voting for marriage as it is, not marriage in some new creation demanded by the Massachusetts Judicial Court. So the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, I think, actually activated a huge number of conservative Christians like myself to say, this is for real. This is crazy that four out of those seven people could change the law in the state of Massachusetts to something that the people of Massachusetts clearly don't want. And that could happen in Georgia. And we don't believe that that apart from protection of our law by the state constitution being changed, that we had any protection. And I think it's the same federally. I think we need a federal marriage amendment for the same reason. And if you took a vote on should we or should we not have a federal marriage amendment, the citizens of this country would come out, I would say, at least two-thirds would be in favor of it without any question.
I'm wondering, Karen, just hang on half a second, Ed, just to take this a little bit further. When we talk about the social issues or the moral issues or these things that you say were so powerful that it was easy to sort of motivate people and get them out to vote, I'm trying to think of that in context of what the politicians are saying the day after the election, saying, well, you know, we need to unite and not divide. I don't see a lot of room for compromise on these issues, do you?
Well, why do you compromise if 78% of Georgians want a defense of marriage?
Absolutely, that's what I'm saying.
What's the point of compromise? We won. And I hope that there's not so much, quote, conciliation on the part of the conservatives all across the issues that are important to conservatives, that we give away what we've fought for and won in electing George Bush, electing for the first time in Georgia a Republican House of Representatives, first time since Reconstruction we have a Republican House here. We've overwhelmingly endorsed his vision and the GOP vision of America, which embodies a clear sense of right and wrong, of principle, of a rejection of relativism and do your own thing and hostility toward moral values and rebellion against the very notion of right and wrong. So if we trade away all of what we've been fighting for 30, 40 years more, to be conciliatory and nice guys, I think we're a little bit crazy. I think what we need to do is be tolerant and accepting and civil in our discourse about all this. And I think that's embodied. As Ed mentioned, it's not a matter of intolerance. It's a matter of having principles and standing by them. And frankly, I think that's where our nation started, and that's where a lot of us want to get back to. We want a culture of civility and tolerance, but of principle.
Karen, I thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you so much.
That's Karen Labar joining us on the line from Atlanta, Georgia. Ed Goas, you wanted to jump in here.
Just to point out the way you worded it when you asked the question.
Yeah.
There was almost an implication of an activation of these voters to turn out, 80% of our voters to turn out to vote for this. That's not the issue. There were activists out there working on this issue. The bottom line is when you're seeing 65, 70, 75, 80% of the voters who turn out on Election Day saying, this is how we feel about this issue, that is how the American public feels about this issue. One of the things, and there have been many who have tried to warn the equal rights groups in terms of the gay community, that this move towards gay marriage was going to be harmful. When you look at Gallup polling that was almost even on civil union, before this issue became an issue in Massachusetts and put it before the forefront of so many of the voters nationwide. Once the Massachusetts discussion began, the American public went to 60-30 against in wanting marriage to be between a man and a woman officially. And so if I were running a campaign and I went from even to all of a sudden I'm down 2-1 and didn't see those numbers move an inch over a period of 7 or 8 months, I would tell myself, I'm wrong on this issue, or at least I'm wrong in terms of the way, or I've lost the battle in terms of the way the American public is perceiving this issue.
Let's hear from Terry Eastland, who's been listening on the phone. He's publisher of the Weekly Standard. Terry, it's good of you to join us.
Well, thank you, Dick. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. You've got an editorial in your web version of the magazine now where William Crystal is writing that this is, and I'm quoting him here, an accomplishment of ideological confirmation. Is that a good way of putting it?
I think it is. I think it's fair enough to say that there were several issues at stake Tuesday. Foreign policy, I think domestic policy, including the values issues that have already been discussed on this phone, in this conversation. I think all of these matters do have an element in them of, if you will, ideas or ideology. And it's a confirmation, I think, of the direction that Bush has taken the country.
And what about those people who are members of the Republican Party because they like the idea of small government? We were talking earlier about small versus effective. But there is that, I understand, to be a fairly strong part of the party that likes the idea of smaller government and a smaller deficit. What are they taking from this election?
Dick, I'm not sure how big that group is anymore. I mean,
yeah.
I noticed what Ed Goas said earlier, and I think that there is a debate that has occurred in the Republican Party over the last... Well, really, it started with Barry Goldwater, as we know, in terms of sharply limited government, small government.
Right.
But that position is really not held, I would say, by a significant portion of at least those in the Congress who are Republicans. I mean, look at the kind of spending we've had. Look at the fact that George Bush, and I've criticized him on these grounds, didn't even use his veto power to try to constrain spending. Now, there are lots of questions of fiscal policy involved here, and we really don't have time to go into those, but I would just say that I don't think that that's the issue. I think Bush, really, with his first campaign, when he started in '99 for the presidency, he wanted to shift the focus away from the kind of sharply limited government issues that had prevailed, at least certainly with some members of the Gingrich Congress, to what he called compassionate conservatism. And implicit in that was that, look, we will use the power of government for conservative ends, if you will. And that's a different proposition from what you saw in Goldwater and even what you saw really with Reagan, I would say. If you look at his inaugural address, if you look at his emphases, that was not so much how he thought of that, although occasionally he governed in the same fashion Bush has tried to do now. But again, I think it's the use of the powers of government for certain conservative ends. And you see this with the ownership society, for example, that the president has been talking about here in the second term.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we look at the second term Bush administration moving forward, what people should expect from that government. 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to take a call from Norfolk, Virginia, and Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, the reason I call is I'm kind of put off by what seems to be an image of Democrats as being non-caring. It seems as though a lot of people on the right seem to think they have the market cornered on compassion and they're good, and Democrats are portrayed as not good and not compassionate or not caring. I go to church. I'm a Democrat. I go to church. I volunteer for the Red Cross. I have principles as well. The right isn't the only side with principles. It's just that I think we each choose right and left our own principles that we care more about. I care about health care and education and about the middle-class worker, whereas it seems to me the people on the right, the voters on the right, care strongly, are strongly anti-abortion and things of that nature. I think we all care about these things, but we care more about certain principles.
I wonder, Jeff, whether or not you felt your views as a church-going Democrat were being properly and accurately and powerfully put forward by John Kerry as the candidate in this campaign, because I've seen a lot of writing just in the last couple of days that he wasn't really able to articulate, to present your perspective in this election. He kind of gave that ground to the Republicans.
Well, I think the Democratic Party as a whole, in every sector, every state, every ward, every precinct, they need to address the issue of putting forth the idea that, yes, we are caring people. We do have principles. And I don't think that's done well enough. And I think until the Democratic Party starts doing that, they're going to continue to compile losses.
Ed, why don't you help us with why it is that the Democratic Party appears unable to articulate that?
I have to say, I mean, I've been sitting here smiling with the caller's comments because the Republican Party for the last 25, 30 years has had to deal with this class warfare that we don't care. We don't care about the middle class. We don't care about the common worker. We don't care about the average everyday people. So we have had much the opposite kind of reaction of what we've had to deal with, trying to say, well, Republicans are people too. We don't just care about big business. If you look at this campaign, and I think we're getting too much of a focus just on the values part, the overwhelming dominant issues was the war on terrorism, homeland security, war in Iraq, and the economy, to include health care. Values was kind of another major part. The exit polling, to the extent you can look at exit polling, showed that moral values was about 20% of the electorate in terms of their focus. That was always a major part, but not a dominant part of this discussion. But I think that was one of the things that for the Republican Party, that George W. Bush did in a very substantial way in the 2000 election, talking about compassionate conservatives, that in fact conservative values, as conservative approach to governance can be at the same time very compassionate. And I think all the caller is kind of reflecting is that, in fact, George W. Bush has been very successful in driving home that message.
Terry Issa, let me hear from you. Do we look at Jeff's concern here as a triumph of good politics on Bush's part or also as a failure on the part of the Democratic leadership?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, again, what Ed has just said is historically the case. I mean, Republicans were accused of being heartless and so on and so forth. The conservative response, the Republican response to that eventually became, well, look, we are not heartless. We are indeed compassionate, and we have policies that will work that are better for people. And I think the welfare reform bill, for example, in 95, 96, is a good example of that, and that is one, of course, that Clinton wound up supporting. And that has worked for a lot of people much better. It's been much more, if you will, of a service to them than the former policies were. Now, I think going forward, or at least as we – let's look at the campaign just a bit. I think John Kerry did try to define values really in the way our caller did in terms of concern for the poor, caring for the sick. I'm now reading from the Kerry website, feeding the hungry, respecting the environment. I mean, there are a number of values issues that John Kerry stressed. He wanted to define the values in his terms differently from the way the president did in his campaign. The fact of the matter is, for whatever reason, the values as he defined them did not resonate sufficiently with enough voters. These voters that were identified as values voters in the exit polls, I think overwhelmingly 80% of them, I mean, Ed can tell us exactly, but 80% of them went for George W. Bush. That means he was able to define values in terms that worked with the electorate.
Okay, I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our next caller's in Boston. We're going to Henry, who's joining us on the line. Hi, Henry.
How are you doing, Dick?
I'm fine.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, what are you thinking?
Well, people keep talking, the Republican Party in particular, keep talking about, you know, a mandate. Again, I just wonder, are 3 million, a difference of 3 million votes out of 106 million voters, you know, granted, compared to the ratio during the 2000 election, yes, it's a much better showing by the Republicans, but is it really a mandate?
Well, why wouldn't you just see it in simple terms of who won and who lost, and the winner gets to make the rules?
Well, they were going to do that anyway, whether they had a popular vote win or not. So again, why make all this big fuss about a mandate? I mean, I think it's pretty clear that it's still pretty darn close.
I think that any comments about it being a mandate may be an overstatement. I would agree with that. However, I think what I look forward to, and I think what many in this country look forward to, is that we've gone through a very contentious debate in this country. I think that the polarized American electorate has been overanalyzed and overstated from a very negative context, as opposed to the fact that we're basically at parity and we're basically even on loyalty. I think what you do see coming out of this election that I look forward to is an endorsement of, by a majority of the American public, of the policies when it comes to the war on terrorism and the direction this country is going on the war on terrorism, to the economy and the direction this country is going on the economy, and that hopefully we can recognize some of the true gains we have made, both on the war on terrorism and on the economy. Both still have problems. Both still have people that are being left behind, that in fact need help and need focus. But the overwhelming policy now can move forward without the context of a polarized political debate that I think very often have mischaracterized the accomplishments on both policies.
Okay, Terry Eastland, though, when I think partly what Henry's asking is that when we talk about, in particular, economic and social policy, is Bush going to govern from the center or is he going to govern from the right?
Well, Dick, let me just say, I thought you stated exactly what is the case, though. I think if you win the election in the Electoral College, you're the president, you have the opportunity to attempt to govern. Now, prudence may dictate how you go about that, but I think that is the mandate in the sense that you have the authority, the executive power to proceed.
So how much prudence does 55 million votes buy? Because that's what the Democrats are wondering.
Well, I know, and I think it buys a fair amount. I think that also history does in the sense that this is a second term. You know, the president is barred from running for a third term. I think George W. Bush has a demonstrated record in Texas, and certainly I think beginning in the first part of his administration with the No Child Left Behind Act, where he worked with Ted Kennedy, by the way, on that particular legislation, I think you'll see the president try to make common cause. I mean, we are going to have a new minority leader in the Senate, for example, and it was difficult, I think, between Tom Daschle and George Bush. Maybe it will be less difficult this time around. So I think there will be some reaching out. There will be some common cause found, I hope, certainly. But I also think that the president shouldn't yield on certain basic principles. I mean, for example, judicial selection. I think the president should continue to find nominees who share his judicial philosophy, and he should put them forward. And so I think that we will see efforts to reach out, but also I think the president will stand on his principles.
1-800-423-8255, Connection listeners, your chance to join our conversation about the options that face the Republican administration now, control of the White House, control of the Senate, control of the House, and whether or not this is a time for some dramatic moves, a revolution as some are describing it, or a more careful stepping ahead for a president who's entering his second term. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This is a week to talk about what the new Republican administration, or the same old Republican administration, or a mix of the two, will have in store for the country, taking a measure of how the president will see this as a mandate, as a gesture from voters to move ahead with exactly the same policies that he's offered for the past 3 years. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. Terry Eastland is with us. He's publisher of the Weekly Standard, joining us on the phone from McLean, Virginia. And Ed Goas, who is head of the Terrence Group, is also with us. The Terrence Group is a top Republican survey organization. A reminder, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to New Albany, Indiana for our next call. And Ruth Ann is with us. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Good morning. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I kind of wanted to talk about the Democrats in this whole conversation and what we didn't do. And I know there's a lot of hand-wringing and there's a lot of depression and even somewhat nausea in my house. I'm fairly sick about this, the whole outcome. But I really think what the Democrats need to do in the next 4 years, well, we need to probably find a marketing genius along the lines of Karl Rove, because I truly think Karl Rove is the master of the Republican win.
I'm wondering, though, Ruth Ann, when you describe your sense of despair over the results of this election, whether or not you're also talking in the House about, okay, what would we have this president do? Have you so written him off, or if you had a chance to, you know, say something about the options that he has ahead of him, what would you ask of this president?
Well, based on record, and see, I do think this election was a referendum on the last 4 years, and I'm not real optimistic about it. I truly am not. I already know his position on who he wants in the judiciary. I know they're looking at appointees, you know, in their early middle age so that they'll be on the bench for, you know, a couple generations. So I sort of feel like for the rest of my life, it's pretty much over, which is, you know, too depressed for the rest of your listeners. I really shouldn't say that because I do have some ideas what I think the Democrats need to do to kind of get back in the game. And that is to sort of take a page from the Karl Rove playbook and talk about moral values. I mean, this issue has taken such primacy. And to educate people who are looking maybe just not seeing the forest for the trees, you know, they sort of have one issue on moral values, that preventive war is not a moral value, that protection of the environment for the unborn of the entire world is pro-life.
You know, Ruth, I'm going to invite you to call us back when we do an hour on what the Democrats have to do. I don't want to go too far into that list, though. I want to take the essence of what you're saying and turn it to Ed Goas in terms of how much of this sort of reluctance or unwillingness to even countenance another 4 years is going to be a problem for the Bush administration.
Well, I think there are going to be segments of the American public that feel very strongly about that.
What about the legislature as well, though?
Very partisan. I think, you know, again, not to pick on you, but going back to the way you phrased the question before, is the president going to govern from the center or govern from the right? I started off at the beginning of this conversation trying to explain that, in fact, the center of American politics is center-right.
Right.
And that, you know, there always is a problem with the intelligentsia, if you will, on both sides, the right and the left, that believe if you are given the same information that they have, you will come to the same conclusions they have come to. That is not what happens with the American public. They have their own experiences. They have their own way of kind of filtering through that information. And so I think very often the intelligentsia, the elitist, whatever term you want to use, very often miss where the American public really is in terms of looking at policies. Clearly, the dominant issues, values, were an important part of this election, but not the overwhelming part of this election. Direction of the country, principles on where this country was going and how it was going to be governed were a major part of this debate. And that's where I think you're going to see it really be not only a continuation of, on the war on terror, the economy, some of those basic principles, but as we get a better economy, as we are able to bring more and more in line the war on terror, where we can focus on some of these other areas, you will see whether it's education, whether it's health care, whether it's Social Security, you will see actions in that direction. I think both sides, as opposed to trying to define, and I think liberals after this election can't define what the center of American politics are. They need to realize where the center of American politics are. What is true with both sides is we see the same problems. We may have a different way of approaching the solutions, and I think that is where there is a openness to discuss what the best solutions are. As long as the liberals don't fall into the trap they have year after year after year, which is, if you look at it my way, that's a compromise. If you look at it your way, then you're just being short-sighted.
All right, let's go back to our callers. To Boston next. Luke's on the line. Hi, Luke.
Hi.
So what are you thinking?
I wanted to discuss a comment that was made about the picking people with the same judicial philosophy as Bush. And I think that that's completely wrong, and for this reason, that almost 50% of America voted against Bush, and a little over 50% voted for him. And he's there as the president of the United States, not of Bush and his party. So he does need to elect some people with some other philosophies, too, because not only his philosophy is important, but, you know, everyone in America as a whole philosophy is important. I think it's wrong to, you know, just elect people just with your philosophy, because you need other views around you.
All right, let's put that to Terry Eastland, because, Terry, a little earlier in the program, Karen LaBarre was speaking from Georgia about how
right.
important she and other conservative Christians feel about the way that the Supreme Court or the judicial system ought to behave in the country. I don't think that she'd be too happy to see, you know, someone from the left and someone from the right. I think she's got some pretty strong expectations there. How does Bush manage this?
Well, look, as a general rule, I think whoever the president is, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, really is entitled to appoint to the courts those who share his judicial philosophy. And he does not have to simply, you know, make a diversity of selections from all sides among those he might appoint.
So how do you make that case to Luke, who's saying, hey, what about the other side?
Well, I would say to Luke that I think Bill Clinton was entitled to, and I think that large deference should be really given by the Senate in terms of the choices made by the president, all of the considerations, you know, having been gone through, such as temperament, background, and so forth. But I also think if you want to in the Senate, this is where I would disagree with the White House. I think you can invoke judicial philosophy as a ground to oppose a nominee if you like. And I think the real question for the Senate is going to be whether the minority in it, and it's a smaller minority, by the way, now, is going to try to filibuster Bush judicial nominations. And
Luke,
I think that would be wrong.
What are you thinking, Luke?
Well, I mean, I understand to a certain point where he's coming from, but, I mean, if you just want to press only your idea as president, you're no longer an American president. You're a dictatorship at that point.
Well, not,
you need to listen to the American
right.
people.
That's not right at all. Was FDR a dictator because he appointed people who shared his judicial philosophy? I mean, was President Washington? I mean, I don't think so. I think that these are the sort of things, look, you can put somebody up. If there's sufficient objection to that person, someone else will be nominated. That is the American way, I would say. I mean, a great example of this would be the Robert Bork nomination, where President Reagan failed with that nominee. He appointed someone else eventually. It was Justice Kennedy, we now know. And Justice Kennedy, on certain issues, I think pleasing to liberals, has turned out to be more moderate than just Justice Bork would have been.
Ed Goess, how much of a debating point do you think this judicial philosophy is going to be over the next 2-3 years?
Very little. And again, I think once you get away from the distortions of positions that occurred during a campaign, I think you'll find that there is much more reason. It is not as narrow of a measurement that the president is applying to his judicial appointments. And I think we can get away from the politics and look at the quality of the individuals that are being put forward that are not being put forward to represent a conservative agenda as much as the way they view the Constitution and enforce the law.
Okay, well, be more specific with me. Do you think that Roe v. Wade is something that will still be on the books at the end of this administration?
Yeah, I think it will still be on the books.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Durham, North Carolina, and Kelly's with us. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. What are you thinking?
I'm a Democratic voter, and the things that have been said this morning just reinforce for me how dangerous the next 4 years are going to be for the 48% of us who did not vote for George Bush. And when Karen LaBarre said, "Why compromise? We won," I found that offensive as a Christian and offensive as an American.
Can I ask you, Kelly, though, what you or how you would expect this to play out at the congressional level? Is there going to be that same degree of difference of opinion in your view?
Well, I don't know, but I certainly hope that the far right pressures in this administration are resisted at every turn by the Democrats in Congress, because, you know, as a gay person, the stuff about not being intolerant that Karen LaBarre, well, you know, we want to express our opposition to these values, but mm-hmm. not in an intolerant way. Well, you know, I am one of those people you turn to when you need help. I am a very busy person, you know, but I work in my community. I am active in my community. I am, you know, a religious
I need you to
person.
Cut to the point here, Kelly.
Well, it just offends me that in a country that is supposed to protect the rights of all citizens and everyone's right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that why compromise we won is an acceptable American value.
Okay, let me stop you there, Kelly. Thank you for your call. Ed Goess, just on that point of how this is going to play out in Washington at the legislative level, whether or not there is going to be that same sort of sense of outrage you hear from Kelly.
Well, first of all, I think her comment about why compromise is on the principle of gay marriage. And that there is a very strong feeling, overwhelming public support for marriage being between a man and a woman. I think the tolerance comes in on that there are a variety of different rights that can be legislated to the gay community that has nothing to do with marriage and does have to do with their rights in terms of assets, in terms of even things like visitation in the hospital. Those things can be legislated without going down the path of fighting the battle on gay marriage or either having it or not having it. And I think you'll see, hopefully, that is where the openness and the tolerance will come in, and the legislators across the various states and more specifically in Washington, that the message of rights will be addressed as opposed to getting bogged down in the gay marriage issue.
And Terry, we're going to get our first measure of the president's attitude going into his second term in just a few minutes when he makes his remark, sort of his first public remarks after that speech yesterday and holds a news conference. What would you be advising him to say? What would be the headline that you'd slip him for this one?
Well, I would go back to the war on terrorism in Iraq. I mean, I do think, and we haven't talked about it much in this conversation, but I still think that that really is the overriding issue for most Americans. I mean, in the sense that we're conscious of it all the time. We're aware still of 9/11.
Right.
We live in a post-9/11 country, as George Bush himself might say. And I think all of us, I mean, I am someone that has criticized the president's handling in Iraq. I was willing to defer to his decision to go in. But I think that there have been mistakes made, if you will, if I can put it like that. And I think that he needs to give some assurance that we're going to get this job done well. I think, and correctly, I should say, I think that the election, I would look at the election as rejecting the Kerry proposition that we need a fresh start. I think people might have been a little too nervous with that, and they wanted to try to see if George Bush could make this thing right, and also more generally with the war on terrorism. So I think that is what he's got to speak to today, really. And I think he also needs to indicate, like what Ed says, governing from the center right. If he can express that concept in terms, I'm sure his speechwriters are quite capable on this point. I think you will see a reaching out to Democrats in this speech, to John Kerry and John Edwards in this speech.
Terry, we've got to go. We're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us.
Okay.
Terry
Good.
Eastland is publisher of the Weekly Standard. And Ed Goas, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
I'm going to work on that center-right thing, you'll be pleased to know. Ed Goas, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Terrence Group. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.